protection remains very strong against severe infections and hospitalizations caused by any version of the coronavirus, and those most at risk are still the unvaccinated. We're prepared for an article written jointly by Julie Steenhuisen, Alistair Smout, and Ari Rabinovich. The piece is titled How the Delta Variant Upends Assumptions About the Coronavirus. The article has been published by the Reuters news agency. According to virologists and epidemiologists, the Delta variant is the fastest, fittest, and most formidable version of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 the world has encountered, and it is upending assumptions about the disease, even as nations loosen restrictions and open their economies. According to interviews with 10 leading COVID-19 experts, vaccine protection remains very strong against severe infections and hospitalizations caused by any version of the coronavirus, and those most at risk are still the unvaccinated. The major worry about the Delta variant, first identified in India, is not that it makes people sicker, but that it spreads far more easily from person to person, increasing infections and hospitalizations among the unvaccinated. These experts said evidence is also mounting that it is capable of infecting fully vaccinated people at a greater rate than previous versions, and concerns have been raised that they may even spread the virus. Microbiologist Sharon Peacock, who runs Britain's effort to sequence the genomes of coronavirus variants, said, "The biggest risk to the world at the moment is simply Delta, calling it the fittest and fastest variant yet. Viruses constantly evolve through mutation, with new variants arising. Sometimes these are more dangerous than the original virus. Until there is more data on Delta variant transmission, disease experts say that wearing face masks, social distancing, and other measures set aside in countries with broad vaccination campaigns may again be needed." Public Health England said on Friday, 23rd of July, that out of a total of 3,692 people hospitalized in Britain with a Delta variant of the coronavirus, 58.3% were unvaccinated and 22.8% were fully vaccinated. In Singapore, while Delta is the most common variant, government officials reported on Friday, 23rd of July, that three-quarters of its coronavirus cases occurred among vaccinated individuals, though none were severely ill. French health officials have said 60% of current hospitalized COVID cases are in vaccinated people. Most of them are aged 60 or older and often have underlying health problems. In the United States, which has experienced more COVID-19 cases and deaths than any other country, the Delta variant represents about 83% of new infections. So far, unvaccinated people represent nearly 97% of severe cases. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine appeared only 41% effective at halting symptomatic infections in the United States over the past month as the Delta variant spread. American experts said this information requires more analysis before conclusions can be drawn. Researchers said protection for the individual is very strong. Protection for infecting others is significantly lower. A study in China found that people infected with the Delta variant of the coronavirus carry 1,000 times more virus in their noses compared with the ancestral Wuhan strain, first identified in that Chinese city in 2019. Microbiologist Sharon Peacock said, "You may actually excrete more virus, then that's why it's more transmissible. That's still being investigated." Virologist Shane Crotty of the La Jolla Institute for Immunology in San Diego, California, noted that Delta is 50% more infectious than the Alpha variant first detected in the United Kingdom. Shane Crotty added, "It's outcompeting all other viruses because it just spreads so much more efficiently. Genomics expert Eric Topol, director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute in La Jolla, California, noted that Delta infections have a shorter incubation period and a far higher amount of viral particles. Eric Topol said that's why the vaccines are going to be challenged. The people who are vaccinated have got to be specially careful. This is a tough one. In the United States, the Delta variant has arrived as many Americans, vaccinated and not, have stopped wearing face masks indoors. Eric Topol said, "It's a double whammy," adding, "The last thing you want is to loosen restrictions when you're confronting the most formidable version of the virus yet." The development of highly effective vaccines may have led many people to believe that once vaccinated, COVID-19 posed little threat to them. Carlos Del Rio, a professor of medicine and infectious disease epidemiology at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, said, "When the vaccines were first developed, nobody was thinking that they were going to prevent infection." Del Rio added, "The aim was always to prevent severe disease and death. However, the vaccines were so effective that there were signs the vaccines also prevented transmission against prior coronavirus variants." Del Rio added, "We got spoiled." Dr. Monica Gandhi, an infectious disease doctor at the University of California at San Francisco, said, "People are so disappointed right now that they're not 100% protected from mild breakthroughs, getting infected despite having been vaccinated." But Dr. Monica Gandhi added, "The fact that nearly all Americans hospitalized with COVID-19 right now are unvaccinated is pretty astounding effectiveness."
Communique.
Benjamin Netanyahu has finally been outplayed. His numerous attempts to stay in power, outmaneuver his opponents, and keep his political rivals at bay granted him a reign lasting from 2009 until 2021. But that has come to a swift end. He's been replaced by Naftali Bennett, a man who proudly claims to be even more right-wing than his predecessor and has openly bragged about killing Arabs. So the question now is, what difference does this make for Palestinians? What difference does it make for the region and for those living under Israeli occupation for the better part of almost 80 years? What of their fate?
I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Now, before proceeding with the program, it's important to note that Israel is not a legitimate state. It is a racist entity that has been illegally occupying Palestine since 1948 and Syria's Golan Heights since 1967. So when we speak of a so-called Israeli government, we are talking about the administration or the regime that is running the occupation and nothing more. Israel is not recognized as a country by a majority of Arab and Muslim countries and is no more a country than the British occupation in India or the German occupation of Poland or France. Their so-called elections, ministers, and officials have no legitimacy and will only be referred to as such in the program for the sake of simplicity and brevity, nothing more. Now, on June 13, 2021, Benjamin Netanyahu lost his title as the Prime Minister of Israel. In the timeline of events preceding his downfall, many things occurred that led to his ouster. During the last 2 years, from 2019 to 2021, the Israelis had held 4 elections, all of them inconclusive, as no party was actually able to win a majority out of 120 seats. On April 6, 2021, Netanyahu was given 28 days to form a coalition government, but was unable to do so. And consequently, a few weeks after, on May 5th, the president of the Israeli occupation, Rivlin, turned to another Israeli politician named Yair Lapid, who heads the centrist party Yesh Atid. Just a few days after being given this task, Israel launched a new assault on Gaza on May 10th, with massive bombings of public and health infrastructure, slaughtering hundreds of Palestinians and leaving thousands more wounded. Keep in mind that Netanyahu has been troubled by a massive corruption scandal during the last years, a case that remains open and still not reached a conclusion. And it's widely speculated, and perhaps not unreasonably so, that throughout his tenure, Netanyahu has resorted to many tactics, exploiting various crises, such as attacking Gaza, in order to distract from his internal problems and rivalries. Now, his political rivals stopped just short of publicly accusing him of attacking Gaza in May as a ruse to distract from his corruption scandal and troubles of forming a coalition government. And indeed, for a moment, this proved to be fruitful, with multiple outlets reporting that any hopes of a coalition government had been eviscerated. After all, nothing unites Zionists more than the oppression and occupation of Palestinians. But nevertheless, despite his attempts to crush the hopes of his rivals in wrestling the premiership from him, after the ceasefire between Hamas and the Israelis, brokered by Egypt on May 21st, talks between Netanyahu's rivals of forming a coalition government to get rid of him resumed in the wake of the bloodbath that had left so many killed and injured in Palestine. On May 30th, 2021, Naftali Bennett announced that he would be joining with Yair Lapid in the aim of forming a so-called unity government. This would include a coalition of 8 different parties from all across the political spectrum. On June 2nd, minutes before the deadline, a coalition government was forged, which would see the role of Prime Minister shared, with Bennett taking the reins for 2 years, and then Lapid. On June 13th, 2021, Naftali Bennett was sworn in as Prime Minister, and during his speech in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, several Netanyahu loyalists attempted to interrupt him, accusing him of treachery as they were being removed from the chamber. Netanyahu himself gave a fiery speech accusing his rivals of election fraud, and much like former US President Trump, refused to accept the results, calling it the greatest election fraud in history, perhaps even in the history of democracy. When entering the Knesset, he sat in the Prime Minister's chair before being told to relocate to a different seat. And in the final moments of his ouster, Netanyahu implied that the new government was doing the bidding of Tehran, of Hamas and Hezbollah, by gifting them with his removal from power. And then he gave a final warning just before he left, saying, quote, "We'll be back." Indeed, he intends to remain the leader of his Likud party and to lead the opposition, with many speculating that Netanyahu will be back and that he'll try to run again and wrestle control of the premiership back into his grasp. Now, what makes the coalition put together interesting is not just the fact that it's comprised of 8 parties on seemingly opposing ends of the political spectrum, but also includes for the first time some Israeli Arab politicians as part of the United Arab List. Now, 8 parties, all united by their common hatred for Netanyahu, managed to get rid of him. But what of his replacement? What of Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli Prime Minister, and the head of the far-right party, New Right, which is also under the umbrella of the Yamina movement, an ultra-nationalist movement? Naftali Bennett originally started outside of politics. He made his fortunes as a tech millionaire. Having lived for a while in the United States, his parents are originally American Jews who moved from the United States to occupied Palestine. Like most Israeli settlers, either they themselves, their parents, or their grandparents all come from outside of Palestine. They are not indigenous to Palestine. Just ask any Palestinian where their grandparents were born, and I can assure you, most of them will not tell you the USA or Germany or Ukraine or wherever else. Now, before politics, Bennett was also part of the Israeli occupation forces and took part in numerous attacks on Lebanon, including the Qana massacre in 1996, when the Israelis shelled a United Nations compound, killing 106 Lebanese civilians. Originally, Bennett entered politics under a right-wing party and then went on to join Yamina, which identifies as ultra-nationalist. Once again, it's a bit difficult to understand what they mean here, since every political party there by default validates the Israeli occupation and upholds its existence, which by its very nature oppresses Palestinians in favor of a Jewish nation state. Now, Bennett has always publicly opposed a Palestinian state and always supported the expansion of illegal settlements. At one point, he was the head of the Yesa Council, a large settler organization. Needless to say, these settlers live in Palestine illegally. There are multiple United Nations Security Council resolutions stating very clearly that these settlements are unlawful and stand in violation of international law. When it comes to his animosity and hatred towards Palestinians, there's no shortage of comments there. Perhaps to further illustrate how much of a wonderful person Bennett is Let's look at a few of his quotes, shall we? Bennett once said in 2018 that he would, quote, not give another centimeter to the Arabs. In 2013, during an interview with The Guardian, he said, there is not going to be a Palestinian state within the tiny land of Israel. He previously also expressed his disdain for international law, claiming somehow that Israel's numerous illegal annexations, declared null and void by the United Nations, are not illegal, according to him. In 2012, he was quoted in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz as saying, quote, I will do everything in my power forever to fight against a Palestinian state. He's also called Palestinian children terrorists and said, quote, I've killed lots of Arabs in my life, and there's no problem with that. And of course, this is the man that Western leaders like U.S. President Joe Biden and others immediately call and congratulate and grovel to. You see, racism and terrorism are fine with them as long as it's happening to Arabs and Muslims. Equally, Bennett's cabinet members have no shortage of colorful comments either. Yair Lapid, who will take over after 2 years as the alternate prime minister, said that he is, quote, enthusiastically in favor of annexing the Syrian Golan Heights. My principle says maximum Jews on maximum land with maximum security with minimum Palestinians. The new finance minister, Lieberman, said once in 2006 that, quote, any Arab members of the Knesset who meet with representatives of the PA's Hamas-led government should be executed. And previously, when he was transport minister, on Palestinian prisoners, he said that, quote, it would be better to drown these prisoners in the Dead Sea if possible, since that's the lowest point in the world. Benny Gantz, who was supposed to share the premiership with Netanyahu under a coalition agreement, has now been reappointed defense minister and new deputy prime minister. Just one day after assuming the role of prime minister, Bennett proceeded to bomb Gaza on the night of June 15th to June 16th, and then again a second time during the same week on June 17th. In the Israeli and Western corporate media, the story was reported as the Israelis launching airstrikes in response to incendiary balloons launched by Hamas, which of course sounds very proportionate and civilized. Naturally, the media left out the part that this was a response to the flag march in Al-Quds, in the holy city of Jerusalem. One of the first actions taken by Bennett's administration was to approve a right-wing march through the streets of occupied Jerusalem. East Jerusalem was captured in the 1967 war and consequently annexed. It has been under illegal Israeli occupation ever since. These are the same mobs that have been carrying out pogroms for the last few months that just marched through Jerusalem, looting and damaging Palestinian-owned businesses. They have been filmed laughing and joking at the death of Palestinians, calling for a second Nakba and for the ethnic cleansing and genocide of the Palestinian population. All of this, of course, with the protection of Israeli police who stand there and coddle them and do nothing. And not only that, but they participate with them in oppressing the Palestinians. One woman who held a Palestinian flag was filmed being beaten to the ground by Israeli police. Under Bennett, Palestinians were also offered 1 million vaccines by the Israelis, with one caveat: they're expired. And so not only does the medical apartheid continue, but all of the apartheid continues, all of the cruelty, the entire cruelty of the occupation in all its dimensions continues. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities.
Joining me is Dr. Bassem Naim. He is the former Palestinian health minister and now the head of the International Relations Office of Hamas in Gaza. Thank you for taking the time. It's a pleasure to have you on, Doctor.
Please, an honor to be with you today.
So, Doctor, I wanted to ask you, first of all, this new prime minister of the Israeli occupation, Naftali Bennett, he's made remarks in the past that he is proud to have killed Arabs. He is completely against any Palestinian state. I wanted to ask you, this change of leadership, does it mean anything for Palestinians? What does it actually represent on the ground in reality?
Look, for us Palestinians here, it doesn't make any difference between these different Israeli governments, right or left, and if it is a negative change. Look, when it comes to the Palestinian issue, we believe, and this is the practical thing we see on the ground, there is no differences between right and left. All what they are discussing is only internal issues, internal Israeli issues. But not when it comes to the Palestinian conflict, when it comes to the borders, the settlements, to Jerusalem, to refugees, right to return, the right to attack Palestinians, to suffocate them, since 1948, we have a steady, constant policy from all governments. And if there is a change in when it comes to this new government, maybe it is a negative one. I mean, more aggression, more violence against the Palestinian existence here on the land. But if there is a question, we have the right to raise it as Palestinians there today, that why the international community, in particular the West, Europe, and America, are usually exercising a lot of pressures on Palestinians to go on the path of what so-called peace and stability and prosperity, and they are asking us to review our curricula in the schools, they are asking us to review our media, and so on and so on. But when it comes to what so-called the prime minister, who is proud of killing Palestinians or Arabs in general, and he is ready to repeat it again and again, when we have a minister of interior, the so-called Ayelet Shaked, when she is publicly stated that she is calling for killing all Palestinian mothers because they are going to give birth for a new terrorist, I hope that the international community can leave the position of not only double standard, double or triple standards, to hear clear, not only clear statements, but also actions towards the such terrorist government.
How does it make you feel to see Arabs, Palestinians in this coalition government? What kind of message does that send? How does that make you feel?
The Palestinians generally are divided here in two parties. One party see that this is their right to decide how to deal with the status quo without recognizing the occupation as a state, and the other part, which is forbidding totally any engagement, especially at the official level with the Israeli occupation. We here in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, I mean the occupied territories in 1967, we leave this for them to decide how to deal with this with their situation inside the occupied territories in 1948. But on the bottom line, the baseline is not to recognize this occupation or to legitimize it.
So, you know, Doctor, I wanted to ask of you, we saw these Israeli marches through Al-Quds, through Jerusalem, where these mobs are chanting death to Arabs. You know, they're laughing and joking. They're calling for a second Nakba, for more ethnic cleansing. And at the same time, as you saw, unfortunately, they started bombing Gaza again. They broke the ceasefire on May 21st. You know, they attacked public health infrastructure. Many clinics and hospitals were damaged. Al-Shifa Hospital, which I'm sure you know very well, they bombed the road leading there. And I mean, it's not the first time, is it? But, you know, what do you have to say about this massacring of Palestinians that is still ongoing? The damage to infrastructure, the medical apartheid, in the broader context of the occupation of Palestine.
Look, when we hear this group of extremists chanting openly and publicly death to Arabs and death to Muslims, or calling for destroying Al-Aqsa Mosque, or on so on, and protected by the Israeli police and covered by all Israeli media, calling or considering them as heroes, this is reflecting that this is the official policy of the state of Israel. This is not a group of gangs at the periphery of the mainstream of the state. It is in the heart of this group of young people are representing Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked and other official figures in the state of Israel. When it comes to the massacring of Palestinians, again, this is the adopted policy since 1948. Look, if you go through the diary in each day you will have the you will find the memory or the anniversary, sorry, of one or two or three or sometimes in one day five or six massacres committed by the Israel, by the Zionist entity or their groups since 1948 until today, either here in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, in Tunis, and everywhere. Therefore, again and again, this is the adopted official policy of this Zionist entity, how to eliminate the Palestinian existence on this land and around it. When it comes to attacking health facilities or killing children, usually they are using some allegations that they are targeting security offices or offices affiliated to the resistance. First of all, they were not able to show one proof of their allegations until today. Second, we know if they want to target someone specifically, they can do it. You know that they have the most sophisticated weapons, the most precise weapons supported by the Americans. Why to destroy a house or a building with 13 or 14 floor because of the allegations they have one or two offices in this high buildings working for the resistance.
And Doctor, just as a final question, you've been very gracious with your time. I just want to ask you, what can people who are listening, the viewers, what can they do to help the Palestinian cause? And you know, very often we never get to hear directly from Palestinians in the English-speaking world. Everything about Hamas is filtered through the Zionist narrative, through the Western narrative. So I want to give you the floor, and I want to ask you, what would you like to say directly to the viewers, to the audience?
Thank you very much. This is a very important question. And I will start from the point you have raised, because this is the most important point. The Israeli or the Zionist entity is depending on two pillars. The first one, their own capacity or capabilities here, security and air forces and army, and the other one, the international support, because they are presenting themselves as representative of the Western values, of the Western cultures, as a civilized state, as a state which is defending human rights and equity, and so on. This image, I think anyone will be very helpful for the Palestinians if they convey the reality on the ground here, that this is a fascist colonial project violating all kinds of human rights, all kinds of good values, of the values of more or most civilized people, equity and justice and freedom of expression, freedom of journalism. We have seen it live in real time, how they are killing children, how they are attacking women, how they are squashing men and women on crossings in the West Bank or in Jerusalem. Therefore, to help Palestinians to convey their message or to convey the Palestinian narrative to pass through this filter is a very great help for us. The second thing is we Palestinians, we are not war, what we call it in English, we are not war makers or war lovers. We are really looking to live in peace. We are really looking to live that our children have the chance of a better life, a dignified life, to live like any children around the world. And we have given all the chances to the Zionist entity and to the international community to solve this political conflict in a peaceful way or a political way, avoiding further bloodshed and killing of people, of children and women. But they have always denied our basic rights of a statehood, of dignity, of freedom. Therefore, we have resorted to armed resistance, which is guaranteed right in the international law, by the way. It is our full right to resist the occupation. We are the oppressed people, and the Israelis are the oppressor, and we have the right to resist it. But we have resorted to this track or to this tool because we have seen after seven decades that no one is really caring about our life, about our future.
Let us not forget that during his tenure, Netanyahu oversaw the assassinations of several Iranian nuclear scientists. He openly and vehemently rejected the Iran nuclear deal in any diplomatic endeavors. He approved several acts of sabotage and nuclear terrorism against Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities, and then had the nerve to go to the United Nations General Assembly and accuse Iran of developing a nuclear weapon, when Israel is the only party who has nuclear weapons. Netanyahu oversaw the brutal assaults on Gaza in 2014 and again in 2021, with thousands of Palestinians being ruthlessly murdered and wounded. In 2016, he secured the largest package of military aid from the United States in history, totaling $38 billion over a period of 10 years to subsidize these atrocities. He launched hundreds of airstrikes on Syria, if not thousands, taking advantage of the chaotic situation in Syria to attack her while she was weak. Under his rule, the Israelis openly worked to assist and give aid to Al-Qaeda fighters inside Syria just for the sake of helping to topple the Syrian government. Netanyahu tried to move forward with his annexation plan on July 1st, 2020, but ultimately didn't. His plans to annex a further 30% of the West Bank, they didn't come to fruition, but he still tried, and he still got something else in return: normalization of ties with Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates in the form of the Abraham Accords, orchestrated by a grinning Trump, who also moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to occupy Jerusalem and recognized the illegally occupied Syrian Golan Heights as Israeli. So how different is Bennett if he supports all these and more? On the eve of Bennett taking power, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry issued a statement clearly saying that this is not real change, because there is no change in the attitude towards Palestinians. That, quote, "As for the new government's policies, we estimate we will see no difference, or perhaps even worse ones." Similar statements were echoed by Hamas and Palestinians alike everywhere. And indeed, let us be under no illusions. Whether Netanyahu had stayed or is replaced by Bennett makes little difference. Perhaps Bennett is more direct in his approach and his rhetoric and speaks with more animosity, but his actions are just as bad as Netanyahu's, if not perhaps slightly worse. Just like his predecessor, he is in favor of annexation. He supports expanding the illegal settlements. He is in favor of brutal military assaults bombing Gaza, allowing Zionists to march through the streets of occupied Jerusalem unchecked, chanting death to Arabs. Bennett is in favor of ethnic cleansing, of genocide, of oppressing Palestinians, and making sure they never attain statehood, nor be given their basic human rights. Bennett, just like Netanyahu, is the leader of an occupation. It's that simple. And unfortunately, this means that nothing changes on the ground. This means that Palestinians continue to live under a racist, apartheid entity, under colonialism that is supported and subsidized by the West. Indeed, nothing has changed, save for a few faces and a few names. The cruelty of oppression, of occupation, of colonialism and apartheid continues in all its dimensions. This has not changed and not stopped. And therefore, neither should the resistance to colonialism and imperialism. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The entry of the destroyer Sahand and the floating naval base name Makron into the Baltic Sea and the Gulf of Finland, and their docking at St. Petersburg for participation in the parade on the anniversary of Russia's Naval Day, is indeed a feather in the cap of the Iranian Navy. The Iranian Navy is equipped with the state-of-the-art vessels of all kinds and capable of deterring the devilish designs of its enemies. Yet, it is without the least doubt an ambassador of peace, as could be evident by participation of its ships in the St. Petersburg Naval Parade. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kahan International. This article is published under the heading, Iranian Navy Comes of Age. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. It is indeed a great milestone for the Iranian Navy and proof of the independence policies of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The entry of the destroyer Sahand and the floating naval base named Makran into the Baltic Sea and the Gulf of Finland and their docking at St. Petersburg for participation in the parade on the anniversary of Russia's naval day is indeed a feather in the cap of the Iranian Navy. It is not just proof of the friendship between Tehran and Moscow and their joint efforts to safeguard peace, but a slap on the face of the meddling Americans that they cannot do a damn thing. After keeping the regimes of the US and West Europe in suspense following the Iranian Navy's entry into the Atlantic Ocean for the first time ever a couple of months ago, these two vessels have demonstrated the seaworthiness of the Islamic Republic's naval forces, which have finally come of age. Gone are the days of the pre-revolution Iran, when the unrepresentative regime used to buy obsolete naval vessels from the West at exorbitant prices and display these junks as a means of defense in the Persian Gulf. Today, the Islamic Republic of Iran builds its own vessels, ranging from destroyers and frigates to speedboats, submarines, and floating naval bases that are more than a match for any intruding enemy warships, which wisely avoid any confrontation in the narrow Straits of Hormuz. The Iranian Navy is equipped with state-of-the-art vessels of all kinds and capable of deterring the devilish designs of its enemies. Yet, it is without the least doubt an ambassador of peace, as could be evident by participation of its ships in the St. Petersburg Naval Parade. And this speaks of the international might of the Iranian Navy. And, in the words of Iran's Navy Chief, Rear Admiral Hossein Khanzadi, the sailing of Iranian ships to the Gulf of Finland and the easternmost arm of the Baltic Sea is a historic event. He added, "This success means the opening of the gates of the North Sea and Finland to the fleet of the Islamic Republic of Iran Army." It is to be noted that the Gulf of Finland extends between Finland to the north and Estonia to the south, to St. Petersburg in Russia to the east, where the Neva River drains into it. Now, after navigating in the waters of the Atlantic Sea, the next step for the Iranian Navy is expected to be the coast of the Americas, followed by passage through the Panama Canal to the Pacific Ocean. Once the Iranian Navy achieves this distinction, it will have the honor of being the first Muslim country to circumnavigate the world on its way back to the Persian Gulf.
Tens of thousands of people in France, the UK, Italy, and Greece protested against coronavirus restrictions and mandatory vaccination policies, sparking clashes with police forces. The European governments try to force more unvaccinated people to receive their coronavirus shots by using sanctions. In France, nearly 160,000 people held nationwide protests against the implementation of a health pass by President Emmanuel Macron's government. Demonstrators slammed this policy by saying it's an attack on their liberty. Macron's health pass will ban access to restaurants and public spaces for unvaccinated people. During the rallies, tensions flared up as French anti-riot police fired tear gas toward protesters and used water cannons to disperse them. Several demonstrators have also been arrested. Elsewhere in Europe, thousands of Italians took to the streets of Rome, Naples, and Turin against the government's introduction of restrictions on unvaccinated people. Protesters chanted slogans such as "Freedom" and "Down with the dictatorship" over plans for a government certificate known as the Green Pass. The Green Pass is an extension of the EU's digital COVID certificate and will be required from August 6th to enter cinemas, museums, indoor swimming pools or sports stadiums, or eat indoors at restaurants. Thousands of people have also protested in London against what they describe as an erosion of their civil liberties. Demonstrators denounced the UK government's track and trace app, saying it limits their movements. Over 600,000 people are told to self-isolate in 1 week alone this month. The protests come a week after most coronavirus restrictions in England were lifted. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse more than 4,000 people who had gathered in central Athens to protest against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. Police sources claim that some protesters had thrown petrol bombs, prompting the police to respond with tear gas.
Certainly the lockdowns are making people unhappy. They're driving up unemployment. They're adding to general restlessness. But the problem is broader. I mean, I think people are upset about the poor economy, which is and slow economic growth, which is now in its 13th or 14th year.
Tens of thousands of Brazilians took to the streets and called for the impeachment of President Bolsonaro, who is facing increasing pressure as the pandemic exacts a devastating toll. The South American nation has been grappling with the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States, with over 500,000 deaths. Demonstrators and police scuffled in Sao Paulo, with the smoke rising from tear gas canisters and flashbangs exploding. Bolsonaro has seen his popularity declining amid a Senate probe into corruption scandals tied to the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. His approval rating is at a low record of 24%. Bolsonaro has been famously dismissive of the health crisis, the need to wear face masks, and lockdown measures to halt the spread of the virus. In Australia, protesters carried signs and banners reading "Wake up Australia" and "Drain the swamp." Demonstrators defied a month-long stay-at-home order by participating in the unauthorized march in Sydney. Nearly 60 attendees were arrested. Demonstrators clashed with police officers and threw projectiles at them. Authorities suggested that the COVID-related restrictions could remain in place until October.
People have lost faith in the political classes. They don't believe that the politicians in charge know what they're doing. They are quite angry and upset.
In many countries, anti-lockdown anger has merged with other grievances. Demonstrators criticize governments for suspending their right to protest because of the public health crisis. In addition, economic hardship and anxiety have further fueled public anger. According to a multi-agency United Nations report published last week, world hunger and malnutrition levels worsened dramatically last year, with most of the increase likely due to the coronavirus pandemic. The report said nearly 768 million people across the globe were undernourished in 2020, as the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted economies, job markets, and supply chains, as well as inflated food prices. The increase last year was equal to that of the previous 5 years combined. According to the report published by UN agencies including the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Program, and the World Health Organization, Asia accounts for over half of all undernourished people globally, while Africa experienced the biggest spike. The report says more than 149 million children under 5 are estimated to be afflicted with stunted growth. That means their brains and bodies do not grow to their full potential. Also, children who suffer from chronic hunger are more likely to die before reaching maturity. However, food insecurity was already spreading across the globe before the pandemic due to the conflicts, economic recessions, and climate change. That's why nearly all low- and mid-income countries have experienced economic downturns in 2020. Low-income countries are more vulnerable to food price shocks in particular. While a surge in consumer food price inflation predates the pandemic, early lockdown measures and supply chain disruptions induced a spike in the prices. Also, higher transport costs increased consumer food inflation. Some experts believe that food scarcity will probably trigger social unrest and bring people out into the streets, which is likely to make the next few months unstable.
Well, I think that we have to understand that the food problem is not simply a result of the COVID problem, but it's also a profound problem as a result of climate change.
...2020 posed a serious blow to food security around the world, and the effects of the pandemic are expected to linger. In 2030, an estimated 30 million more people may face hunger than would have without the COVID-19 outbreak. Many factors affect food security around the world. Therefore, a food system approach is required to find effective solutions. A report by the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World has recommended a number of actions to help prevent undernourishment. Those include increasing resiliency to conflict, climate change, and economic shocks, and sustainably ensuring access to affordable, nutritious food.
What we have to understand and what we should, as a society, be doing is encouraging increasing local trading systems and community-supported farming organizations such as those that exist around the world. It's called community-supporting agriculture, and they're very, very important because they provide a counterbalance to the increasing control and the lack of diversity that the large corporations are offering.
Food insecurity has been on the rise since the mid-2010s, especially in countries affected by conflict, climate extremes, economic downturns, or battling high inequality. The pandemic only exacerbated these existing challenges, with significant negative effects, particularly for poor nations. Therefore, things are not going to change for better unless nations across the globe start working together.
On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein at the State Department. The meeting comes ahead of discussions on the role of U.S. military forces in Iraq. U.S. media have cited American officials as saying that the two countries are expected to formalize the end of Washington's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. That shift is reportedly planned to be announced on Monday when U.S. President Joe Biden hosts Iraqi Prime Minister at the White House. It could potentially mark a new chapter in the ties between the U.S. and Iraq, 18 years after Washington deployed its troops in the West Asian country. In an interview, the Iraqi foreign minister said the presence of American combat units in Iraq is unnecessary at this stage. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister also stressed that American combat troops should leave his country.
I believe that the U.S. will not fully disengage from Iraq. My guess is they will leave some troops there in at least an advisory capacity, and also that they will augment the official military with private contractors. I don't expect the U.S. to totally leave Iraq.
In the meantime, resistance movements in Iraq say the presence of the U.S. forces in the Arab country will only benefit Israel. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.
Britain has announced the permanent deployment of two warships in the South China Sea amid growing tensions between the U.S. and China. Britain's Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the U.K. will permanently assign two ships in the region by the end of this year. He made the announcement in a joint press conference with his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo on Tuesday.
Following on from the strike group's inaugural deployment, the United Kingdom will permanently assign two ships in the region from later this year, as well as contributing a littoral response group in the coming years to come.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and it hosts the biggest concentration of U.S. military forces outside of the U.S., including ships, aircraft, and troops. The deployment would be after a strike group consisting of U.K.'s Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier and escort ships sailed through the waters in the South China Sea in September. The Queen Elizabeth is being escorted by two destroyers, two frigates, two support vessels, and ships from the U.S. and the Netherlands. It will come to Japan through the South China Sea, parts of which are claimed by China and Southeast Asian countries, with stops in India, Singapore, and South Korea. In a statement on the deployment, Pentagon spokesperson congratulated Britain for its, quote, commitment to an interconnected network of allies and partners who mutually cooperate and support freedom of navigation and a rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific region.
These are actually illusionary entities. Yes, they have sets of laws and they are separate countries, but the globalists who run the United States and the United Kingdom work together as one entity. So what we have is two countries in which the citizens are taught from young age that they live in a sovereign state. But in fact, the two countries of the UK and the US are both under the basic control of a globalist elite.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes, through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway, and has, since 2014, built artificial islands on reefs and installed military bases on them. UK's Defense Secretary has said that London would also eventually deploy a littoral response group to the Pacific. That's a unit of Marines trained to undertake missions including evacuations and anti-terrorism operations.
The UK and the United States function as one entity, especially when they have a common target, which in this time is China and, in a secondary level, Iran.
UK's latest policy announcements are in line with US's anti-China drive. The Biden administration's approach toward China is taking shape. Many believe Biden will continue the policies of his predecessor to contain China. While the US has seemingly reduced its involvement in West Asia, the American military has sought to refocus its attention on preparing for a conflict with its major rivals, China and Russia, which it considers to be major competition in the insatiable U.S. quest for power and influence. However, Washington's economy and military power is on the wane, and whether Washington likes it or not, it has to change its warmongering policies and adopt a rather more cooperative one, something that is not likely to happen anytime soon.
The United States runs what it is typically called a protection racket. You must pay to buy United States weapons and defense systems in order not to be threatened by the boogeymen that they create out of other independent countries. So the United States is always leaning on its so-called allies because, in effect, with the exception of England, with the exception of the UK, all of the other countries are military protectorates or socio-economic and military colonies of the United States.
How the Biden administration actually deals with thorny issues between the two countries is yet to be seen. It will depend on how China responds to U.S. actions. Given the strong negative public sentiments towards each other and their increasingly divergent domestic political practices, the truly benign strategic competition still remains difficult, if not impossible, to achieve.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Some do not understand how exactly the Israeli regime's policy makes normal life impossible for Palestinians in Gaza, even when it's not bombing it. The siege amounts to a war crime. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Electronic Intifada. This article is titled, How Zionist Regime Slowly Suffocates Gaza. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Gaza is still reeling from the Zionist regime's 11-day bombing campaign in May. The Israeli regime assault started just before the Eid al-Fitr, marking the end of Ramadan, and ended with the killing of at least 245 Palestinians in Gaza, including 66 children. The bombs may have stopped.